If you live in the Western United States, you already know that berm morel season 2021 is almost upon us. So I wanted to give you the heads up about berm morel maps from my friends Kristen and Trent Blizzard over at Modern Forager. They take U.S. Forest Service data about wildfires and then pick out the best potential morel burns across almost every state in the Western U.S. You can find the maps at modernforager.com. They will take your berm morel game to the next level. And again, that's modernforager.com for berm morel maps. Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on the Mushroom Hour podcast, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Matt Kasson, Associate Professor of Forest Pathology and Mycology at West Virginia University. Dr. Kasson received his PhD in plant pathology from Pennsylvania State University, where his research focused on using a native fungus as a biological control of the invasive tree of heaven. He also holds an AAS from Paul Smith College and a BS and MS from the University of Maine. His current research areas include fungal arthropod interactions, biological control of invasive plants and pathogens, and the biology and ecology of historic and emerging diseases of forest trees. Dr. Kasson is currently the director of the International Culture Collection of Vesicular Arbuscular Mycorrhizal Fungi, and currently has research focused on the metabolites associated with interactions between arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and their plant partners. Dr. Kasson teaches undergraduate courses on general plant pathology and forest pest management and offers special topics courses for graduate students, including advanced plant disease diagnostics. With so much interesting ground to cover, we could go in a lot of directions, but I'm excited to learn more about plant pathogens and fungal arthropod interactions. Dr. Kasson, thank you so much for joining us on the Mushroom Hour podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have to say it's truly an honor. I've been familiarized with your work just in the general mycology sphere. And then I actually interviewed someone who was part of your lab, Matt Berger, who got me really excited to learn more and talk to you.
Yeah, we're one of these labs that goes in a thousand different directions. You said it in the introduction yourself, we can go in a lot of different directions. And as lab leaders, we tend to have a lot of different spinning plates going at any given time. And I could say that I probably have 100 different plates spinning right now. And, that keeps me really inspired and excited about mycology, working on all these different areas, including biocontrol and interactions with arthropods and historic plant diseases. Each one of my students brings these projects forward, and I get to enjoy that research experience with them. But I get to switch between the students, and the topics are so varied that there's so much crosstalk and so much cross fertility happening there. It's been really nice to have that happen.
Yeah, what a privilege to be the orchestrator of a lot of brilliant minds and fascinating lines of inquiry. And I'll have to admit, a lot of my impression of your work was from the notoriety of things like the cicadas, the flying salt shakers of death that we'll talk about, and a lot of these fungal arthropod interactions. So I was really fascinated to read more about your work and see your work with fungi as a biological control for invasive plants, your research into metabolites of mycorrhizal fungi, which talk about like the mycology frontier, how these interactions between mycorrhizal fungi and plants are mediated. It's just a fascinating field of research. So you really do have 100, maybe 1,000 plates spinning at once, it sounds like. But before we jump into all these, I was curious about your origin story, if you will, the influences that drew you to explore nature and explore science.
Yeah, I think I share a common origin story with a lot of mycologists and plant pathologists. I grew up in a really rural area. I grew up in Susquehanna County, Pennsylvania, which is the most northeast corner of Pennsylvania, the county with the most dirt roads of any county in Pennsylvania. And I grew up adjacent to water company land. So the 1,000-plus acres around my house was just land to be explored. And growing up in a rural area, like most people, I went fishing and hunting and spent a lot of time outside with my dad. I was heavily involved with the Boy Scouts. I'm an Eagle Scout. And that further cemented my passion for environmental sciences and forestry, spending time camping in the woods, learning tree ID, these different things to earn merit badges.
Right.
Kind of further refined my passions for the outdoors to the point where by senior year in high school, I had decided that I really wanted to pursue a degree in forestry. But it was really those hours, you know, and it also speaks to my generation. We spent a lot of time kind of separate from our parents outside running around unsupervised. And it was a really formative kind of experience, but it allowed a lot of self-exploration and, you know, introspection and things like that. But, you know, I recall stomping on puffballs as a young kid. I didn't really know that they were mushrooms. But I was told that they produce poisonous smoke, so we'd stomp on them and run.
Of course.
That's my first memory of actually interacting with mushrooms. It was with puffballs. And I remember seeing them on trees and polypores and things like that. But it wasn't until I got into forestry school and started my college education that I really found that passion for fungi. Because like a lot of people that start in forestry and kind of specialize beyond that, a class in forest health, you know, introduced me to some of these like biotic agents that cause disease in plants. And
right.
Fungi just really grabbed me by the shirt with two hands and said, wow, this is awesome. After my 2-year degree at Paul Smith's College, which was, again, one of these extremely rural experiences in upstate New York and the Adirondacks, I decided to kind of then pursue a 4-year degree. At the time, they didn't have a 4-year degree program for forestry. So I transferred into the University of Maine and continued on with my bachelor's degree there. But from there, I specialized in forest pathology and went on to Penn State, as you said, to do a PhD in plant pathology. But that's kind of my origin story. It starts in running around the woods of rural northeast Pennsylvania, turning over logs and rocks in the river and just seeing what was there.
Already becoming a great field naturalist from a young age. And, you know, it's no surprise then that you'd be lost in the world of exploring the forest and the science of forest ecology and the interactions that go on there because you had such a vivid, direct experience of it. And, you know, it's interesting to me that one of the vectors by which you got interested in fungi sounds like, I don't know if it's the more humble, but maybe some of the more unrecognized fungi that play huge roles in forest ecosystems. Fungal pathogens. What were some of the fungal pathogens you worked with as it applied to understanding forest pathology? And maybe we just go over, you know, general groupings of these certain types of fungi that play huge roles in forest ecosystems as pathogens.
Yeah. When I teach forest pest management and general plant pathology, I talk about the disease types. What type, what part of the plant is being impacted by the pathogen?
Right.
And that's how we kind of, we broadly categorize biotic agents. I mean, when we're talking about forest pathology, generally we're talking about fungi, so we can be specific about fungi here. So we talk about leaf spot diseases. Those are fungi that invade leaf tissue and maybe will spread to twig and fruits and seeds. Root rots, things that decay and break down the roots. Vascular wilt pathogens. Those are pathogens confined to the conductive, water conductive tissue or the of the plants and clog up the water conductive tissues, resulting in wilts, hence the name vascular wilts. And then we also have canker diseases, which is one that I've worked on since I started my career in forest pathology. And I could talk a little bit more about those. And then we talk about rusts separately, even though rust can be in some cases called leaf spot diseases, in other cases be called canker diseases. Rusts are a highly specialized group of plant pathogens, so we tend to kind of keep them separate from the rest of the pathogens. And the rust pathogens are a specific group of fungi in the Basidiomycota. They're in the Puccinomycetes.
Okay, so I like that grouping by what part of the plant that these pathogens affect, but then how specific are each of these species on their host? And maybe as kind of a continuation of that, how many species are we talking about when we talk about pathogens? You know, what are, or how many major species do we have to consider when we're thinking about these forest pathogens?
Yeah, there's a lot to unload there. I think another thing that we talk about in grouping these things is we group them kind of like what's their kind of lifestyle? Are they biotrophic, meaning do they like live on their host and keep their host alive while they parasitize them, or do they kill their host and consume them as they kill them? If you think about powdery mildews, which are classic fungi we see on leaf surfaces, especially lilac and other hosts in the fall or late summer, dandelion's another good one that you'll see this on in your yards.
Yeah.
And you'll see this white powdery surface on the leaves. Yet the leaves are still green. So, you know, how is that fungus colonizing that plant and causing disease? Yet it appears that there's no symptoms on that leaf. And it's because they're producing specialized structures to steal food from the plants without actually killing the host cells. They have specialized organs that draw out nutrients without actually piercing the cell membranes of the leaf tissue. Fungi are not the only plant parasites to do that. We see that with parasitic plants like mistletoes, and we see it in other instances as well. But and then necrotrophs are the ones that are killing the tissue and then consuming the tissue as it's being killed. And they can do that through toxin production and a combination of toxins and enzymes that can break down the different constituents of wood, including like lignin and cellulose and those kinds of things. But to get at your kind of your next question is, it was about more about host range, and host range varies considerably. You know, you have things like chestnut blight, which a lot of your listeners, even if they're not plant pathologists, even if they're not mycologists, they've probably heard of Dutch elm disease and chestnut blight. They're perhaps the two most devastating tree diseases in the U.S. Chestnut blight was introduced at the turn of the last century and basically wiped out American chestnut from the forests. Chestnut still resides in forests, but it's been reduced to kind of a shrubby trash tree that goes through these periodic cycles where it'll sprout, get diseased, and then die back and repeat and repeat and repeat. And Dutch elm disease is more of an urban disease that affected a lot of urban centers in the United States. In fact, go back to your hometown, and I encourage you to look for that elm street in your hometown and then look for a single elm. And you're not going to find the elm because the elms were wiped out by Dutch elm disease. And then what they did is they came and they planted ash trees. And then emerald ash borer came in and wiped out all the ash. So I'm not sure what's on those streets across America that call themselves elm streets, but it's sure not elm and it's sure not ash.
Well, and what do we learn from studying some of these historical diseases? I mean, you just brought two prominent examples that I had written down in my notes here. What can we learn from looking at these kind of horrific examples of tree death from these pathogens?
Well, I want to point out here to your listeners, and it's a really important point, is that in the instances where we're talking about these catastrophic tree diseases, Dutch elm disease, chestnut blight, they're the result of a introduced pathogen meeting a native U.S. plant tree host.
Right.
So there's no resistance, or there's very little resistance to these pathogens because they didn't co-evolve together. So they're meeting for the first time when that pathogen is introduced from its native range into the U.S., where it meets a kind of a naive host, a host that's not doesn't recognize the pathogen and doesn't really have a defense response to that pathogen. So that's an important point that, you know, we're dealing with these, they evolve separately. They didn't co-evolve, and that's important. But the other thing is that government agencies like APHIS perform a very important function in our society to try to limit the introduction and spread of invasive pests and pathogens. But despite efforts to do this, some still get through. You might have heard of a new disease that's kind of common in the Southeast United States called laurel wilt.
What kind of fungal pathogen are we working with here?
So this is a vascular wilt pathogen, meaning that it gets into the vascular wilt or vascular system of members of the Lauraceae. And, you know, you may not know that botanical family by that name, but maybe you've heard of sassafras.
Yeah.
Maybe you've heard of red bay. Maybe you've heard of sweet bay. A lot of these lauraceous plants are susceptible to laurel wilt. And this is an ambrosia beetle vectored fungus. So it's a plant pathogen, but it's also the symbiont or the mutualistic partner of an ambrosia beetle from Asia.
So the ambrosia beetle, if I recall correctly, is actually, and you can explain maybe that mechanism of how they interact, but they're farming that type of fungi, and then they're actually spreading it into the trees.
That's right. And a majority of ambrosia beetles attack and colonize stress trees and trees that are kind of already releasing stress alcohols, volatiles that are attracting the beetles in the first place. But in the case of laurel wilt, this is kind of an exception where they will attack healthy sassafras and red bay and then inoculate them with its fungal partner, Raffaella lauricola is the scientific name of the laurel wilt pathogen. And that'll cause a vascular wilt and the trees will die within a very short period of time. And that's wiped out millions of trees since 2003. It's wiped out millions and millions, tens of millions of trees throughout the coastal plain and the southeast where laurel family plants are really important. Red bay is a huge component of those kind of like Piedmont forests and those coastal plain and forests. So its loss is really devastating.
And I guess why is the ambrosia beetle, is it strictly a food source or what is its symbiotic relationship with that fungal pathogen?
Yeah, these fungi serve as a food source for rearing young. Now, okay. Despite the fact that these beetles are wood boring, meaning they bore into the main stem of the tree or the branches of the tree, they don't eat wood. They push out the wood to grow fungal gardens inside the tree. So if you've ever seen a tree attacked by ambrosia beetles, you'll see basically these very compact sawdust noodles pushing out of the trees. And that's evidence that the beetles are in there and they're trying to push out real estate so that they can open up space to grow fungi and lay eggs and rear their young.
Fascinating. So the fungus farming, ambrosia beetles, and how, I guess, how did those get introduced, if we know, how did those get introduced to the American environment that clearly wasn't ready for them?
Well, like a lot of things, you know, with increased international trade and globalization comes the importation of lots of goods and shipping containers.
Right.
These ambrosia beetles and other wood-boring beetles, including longhorn beetles and buprestids, like the emerald ash borer is a buprestid. We call them flat-headed wood borers, is the kind of common name for that group of beetles. All these beetles can survive in pallet wood, you know, these pallets that are made to put things in shipping containers. So all you need is some pallet wood that wasn't properly treated with chemicals or heat. And you open that container and then the beetles are brought into the ports. They sit in the ports, they get out and then they attack trees in and around those urban areas or those port areas.
Now, in studying some of these fungal diseases, we've just hit on some big ones. And I love this new example you brought up. By studying them, do we develop any defenses? You know, there's kind of that first line of defense, which is keep the pathogen from getting in here, this fungal pathogen, and affecting the trees. But is there any clues that we derive from maybe seeing the mechanism, I should say, of infection? Are there any insights that we're learning, or mostly are you researching those mechanisms without necessarily seeing any immediate application?
Well, we, as mycologists and plant pathologists, spend a lot of time thinking about, especially us that work on fungi, we think a lot about fungal biology and ecology. Right. What are the fungi doing in the environment when we're not watching? Are they able to sexually reproduce? If not, why not? Is it a substrate problem or is it, you know, both mating types aren't present in the environment? I think a lot about those kind of basic questions. Is it able to produce sexual spores and recombine in ways that could combat like new varieties of plants that are put out in response to a plant pathogen? So, you know, the ability to sexually recombine is a powerful tool in the toolkit of a fungus that's looking to attack a specific host.
Right, right. So what are the reproductive strategies of, you know, vascular wilt, or does it change based on that grouping? You know, what kind of reproductive strategies do these pathogens exhibit, if there's any standard structure to that?
Yeah, it varies pretty widely across these different groups of fungi. You know, like a lot of the fungi I study, a lot of plant pathogenic fungi have kind of carved out a niche of just being an asexual mold. They'll produce asexual spores. We call them conidia. And they're really good at doing that. And those conidia can infect, and they don't necessarily need a sexual cycle to be good at what they do.
that's the ultimate reproductive strategy. You don't need a sexual partner.
Yeah. And a lot of these fungi have, you know, could have had sexual recombination capacity at some point and lost it. Others, we just don't know. Like, there's plant pathogens where we've studied them for 100 years, 150 years, and we still have never seen a sexual cycle. But, like, maybe there's evidence of some recombination. So we're like, okay, well, where is it? You know, we go back to the evolutionary centers of origin for these pathogens, and we try to find other mating types or evidence of sexual recombination. And sometimes we find it, but oftentimes we don't. So, yeah, in thinking about what we've learned from these pathogens is one thing in particular with laurel wilt. Some researchers have found that the fungus needs its vector to get from one place to the next. But once laurel wilt got here, there were several other ambrosia beetles that are able to passively disseminate or phoretically carry the spores of this lethal vascular wilt pathogen to new hosts. So, in the absence of the red bay ambrosia beetle, which is the beetle vector for the laurel wilt pathogen, laurel wilt is still able to spread in the absence of that beetle by hitchhiking on the backs of other beetles. These other beetles are fungus farming. It's just that they have their own fungal partners. But it's really important. It's a really important observation because, you know, if we're just looking for the beetle and we're trapping in new locations, then we're never going to see it. But laurel wilt will continue to spread. And certainly there's, I don't work on laurel wilt, and there's a lot of my colleagues do. Right now, it's more in the southeast. I mean, there are new pockets of it in Kentucky and Tennessee, so it's pushing north. It's following the kind of trajectory of some of these other historic vascular wilt pathogens like Dutch elm disease that wiped out and totally erased the existence of elm from our urban centers.
Well, then on the other side of this coin of developing our research and relationship with fungal pathogens, you've done a lot of work in examining them as potential biological control agents of invasive species that we don't want, you know, trees and different plant invasives, and testing out how these fungal pathogens could be effective controls. So maybe tell us a little bit about kind of that arena, and then maybe more specifically the work you've done with Verticillium non-alfalfae and the Tree of Heaven.
Right. Yeah. So I've been working on biological control using organisms to combat organisms
right.
since I started my PhD in 2007. Like you said, my work was on using a native verticillium fungus to control an invasive plant species. And that was, you know, it was really rewarding work. And it really kind of opened my eyes to the whole field of biological control and the limits of the field and the things that one has to think about when moving candidates forward for biological control. Now, this is different than classical biocontrol in that we're not going to the place of origin for our target species. So if I went back to where Tree of Heaven is native in Asia, and I looked for a pathogen there and then imported it to control it here, that'd be more like classical biocontrol.
Right.
What I've done and what I worked on, and I wasn't the one who found this, but we found this vascular wilt pathogen causing disease. It was naturally occurring on the landscape. We isolated it and then exploited it and vetted it for its potential to effectively control our target species, which is Tree of Heaven, and have little impact on non-target species, that is all the other tree species and plant species that co-occur with Tree of Heaven.
And what does that training look like? Because this concept, I think, is a really powerful one that kind of stretches us to say, oh, wow, so these fungal pathogens kind of learn to adapt to new hosts. So what was that process of training it, this native fungi where you are on this invasive tree species from Asia? How did you train it to become an effective pathogen for just that tree species?
I just want to be clear that we're not training it. We're really just evaluating it.
Okay.
What we did is this fungus was found naturally occurring in South Central Pennsylvania back around 2003, 2005. And it was clear that there were massive numbers of trees dying off. Now, when the tissue was taken and isolations were performed, this fungus, Verticillium non-alfalfae, was recovered. And really, the first question that pops in one's head is, well, is this a pathogen? So we have to fulfill Koch's postulates, it's called. So we want to take that pathogen and we would want to put it into healthy tree of heaven and see if it causes similar symptoms to what we observed in the field and right. then re-isolate it out. And that's called fulfilling Koch's postulates. That's very basic plant pathology, how we move from association to kind of causation. And once we get that, you know, of course, the question that stands out at the tip of your brain is, will this have any adverse impacts on non-target species? Right. That is, what is the host range of this fungus? Now, because we found it naturally occurring, it allowed us to do some things that one doesn't often get to do. Typically, host range testing would be done on potted plants, small potted plants, in a controlled greenhouse environment where you can carefully see whether or not these pathogens have the potential to infect and cause mortality or cause dieback in non-target or other hosts.
Right.
Because we had a kind of a naturally occurring epidemic in the landscape, we could flag and monitor over time the non-tree of heaven plants that were in the stands that were co-occurring with the tree of heaven and see what their outcome was and ask 1 year later, are those trees wilting? Are they dying? 5 years later, are those trees wilting? Are those trees dying? And we were able to do that. In some instances, you know, I've been back to some stands that were, it was found naturally occurring in or inoculated in 10 years ago. And those other trees that were there are still doing very well and thriving. They've now taken up more of the space that was occupied by this invasive plant.
Very good, because that gets to the heart of another question I had, which was about the precautionary principle in all this. It sounds like in this case, it was already latently present affecting the tree of heaven, but it, let's say you found an effective fungal pathogen and wanted to test it on an invasive, you know, applying a pathogen to a certain invasive by inoculation or purposely introducing it. My big question was how much do we have to look at this precautionary principle of, you know, what's the host range and all these questions? And I think you've just laid out beautifully how you would test that in kind of a small controlled area.
Yeah. I think the most important thing to say up front is that once you release something, it's really hard to call it back. You can't just whistle and have it jump back in the the inoculum container. I think it's really important to take this kind of work serious up front because you don't want to cause catastrophic losses to native plants. You want to evaluate this in a very methodical, thoughtful way where you're minimizing risk to native plants. That was our approach. Of course, since we had naturally occurring epicenters, and we've since discovered it in Ohio and Virginia and other locations in Pennsylvania. So it's been found in almost a dozen places across three states. And we continue to monitor the impacts on other co-occurring plant hosts in those locations.
In this case, you guys aren't in danger of necessarily opening Pandora's box because it's already out in the environment. But I guess what organizations implement this kind of biocontrol? Because the research is fascinating. You know, you're on this side of examining what the mechanisms are. But what groups then are responsible for implementing any kind of biocontrol if it was introducing a pathogen for invasives? Is it a technique that's very common? And then what's kind of your overlap or the academic overlap with those groups who would implement any kind of biocontrol?
Yeah, these are all great questions. The thing to say first is that these processes take a very long time.
Right.
You know, you might invest 10 years into evaluating the efficacy and host specificity of a potential biocontrol agent and year 9 realize that it has some dramatic non-target impact and it's dead in the water. You may have a really effective biocontrol and in year 10, you still have no way to commercialize it or you can't make a shelvable version of it. So your ability to use it more broadly on the landscape is limited. We've been fortunate that we've had some really good support from the Forest Service and APHIS to use this fungus as a biocontrol of this invasive tree. Not only because it impacts our native forests, and it does, it's been here since 1784 and really has caused tremendous impact on forests, really in the last few decades of the 1900s, after gypsy moth came through and wiped out a lot of our oak, or there was a lot of salvage cutting in the aftermath of that defoliation event or those defoliation events. And when those clear cuts occurred, Tree of Heaven was able to invade those giant openings with tremendous success. And it led to these basically monocultures of Tree of Heaven in forest settings, where they used to be an occasional species or a roadside problem or a rail side problem. They were now basically occupying 40-acre clear cuts on state forests. And really, that's when they became a problem. But that also led to our discovery, because verticillium may have been impacting Tree of Heaven for a long time, right?
Right.
But when trees are dying along the highway in urban centers, or just along the highway in general, where we're using herbicides, there's pollution, stress, you don't necessarily think, oh, there's an interesting disease there. You just think, well, it's the roadside. Trees look like crap. But when you're flying over a 40-acre failed clear cut and you're seeing a wilt disease emerging on a Tree of Heaven, then it's going to stand out to you. And that's exactly what happened. The foresters working on these areas noticed that the Tree of Heaven that had unfortunately colonized these huge, vast acres of land were starting to die back. And that's when we realized that there was enough continuous host there to allow the pathogen to gain momentum and the disease to gain momentum and spread.
So you almost need that huge monoculture to make it stand out enough to clue you in to investigate.
That's right.
And how much is left undiscovered? I mean, in this world of fungal phytopathogens, what is the vast unknown? And I ask that leading question because so much of mycology and the study of fungal ecology, there's vast unknown everywhere. So how much do we have left to discover?
Well, I don't know that I could put a number to it, but I mean, if someone said, you know, characterize the work you do in your lab, I'd say we do biodiversity discovery and analysis. We do biodiversity discovery and analysis.
Yeah.
And we spend a lot of time looking for new fungi in all kinds of environments. And every time we look somewhere, we find something new, which means that there's definitely plant pathogens that are hiding out there. And that's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in recent years. You talked about latency, and you mentioned kind of things kind of hiding out. We've noticed an increase in diseases caused by what are presumed to be cosmopolitan pathogens, that they're present in Europe, they're present in Asia, they're present in North America. And we're only seeing them emerge as problems on the landscape. Why are we seeing them now?
Right.
And that's a big question we ask a lot as plant pathologists, because remember, disease is the coincidental overlap of a favorable environment, a virulent pathogen, and a susceptible host. Now, if the host has been there all along and the pathogen has been there all along, what's changed? It's the environment. The environment has changed, and we know that with climate change, we're seeing unique stresses to forests and ecosystems, and that could lead to the emergence of these opportunistic pathogens that are maybe in the past couldn't do much to impact forest health, but are now starting to emerge as kind of key players in dieback events and mortality events in conifer and angiosperm forests across the globe.
This environmental factor and how, when that changes, it causes an overexpression of the pathogen, which then finally starts affecting the host. I think this is a huge, huge topic of scientific inquiry that's going to affect so many disciplines as we move forward. The realization, you know, that whether it's viruses, whether it's plant pathogens, there's so many of them already latently in the environment. So what is changing that's causing them to overexpress and cause this damage? Wow, what a huge insight you've laid down there.
The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is that a lot of things, you know, when we take our verticillium, for example, when I started working on verticillium as a biocontrol, it was called verticillium alboatrum.
Okay.
With a wide, wide, wide host range, you know, hundreds of species listed in a book. And then there was a taxonomic revision where, using molecular data, DNA-based approaches, we were able to figure out that Verticillium alboatrum was actually Verticillium alboatrum, Verticillium non-alfalfiate, and Verticillium alfalfiate. So through, you know, molecular systematics, we're able to further refine our understanding of pathogens by recognizing that what we called one pathogen in the past is actually three pathogens or six or 15 pathogens that we couldn't really differentiate based on morphology or based on hosts from the past. But using DNA sequences, we're able to say, oh, these are distinct groups. And that refines our understanding of who they are and what they're capable of doing.
Of course, DNA sequencing and the advances in fungal genetics have affected every aspect of mycology. Of course, they have a huge role in terms of fungal pathogens, where you're not necessarily seeing any evidence of the fungi itself. You're more looking at, you know, a damaged or a sick tree and then having to figure out what's in there. So I would imagine advances in genetics would play a huge role in helping to flesh out the fungal diversity.
Yeah. Another example that I think we could talk about, there's a fungus called Colitotrichum that I've worked on, Colitotrichum furinii, which we used as a posited as a biocontrol of poison ivy. Now, when I was at Virginia Tech, I was a postdoc at Virginia Tech after I finished my PhD at Penn State. And I had a colleague who was working on urushiol biosynthesis, which is the compound in poison ivy that leads to the kind of allergic reaction, why everybody gets a rash. And he was growing these seedlings in kind of a sterile environment on this minimal media. So it's kind of like growing the plants on auger rather than growing them in soil. But he kept having the plants die from a fungus. And we investigated and found out it was this Colitotrichum furinii. Now, this fungus is well known as causing post-harvest rots in fruits and berries. And it's also an entomopathogen of the elongate hemlock scale, which is an invasive pest of hemlock and Christmas trees that's, you know, was introduced in the last century, you know, proven to be a problem on hemlock along with hemlock woolly adelgid and proven to be a problem in the Christmas tree industry. And we're working on a project right now to find a fungal biocontrol of that insect. Well, this fungus, Colitotrichum, was posited as the first potential biocontrol of this invasive pest. And a lot of people saw that and probably got nervous, much like the work I did with Verticillium, because they think, well, Colitotrichum is a plant pathogen. Furinii is a known plant pathogen. It's a known post-harvest pathogen. Are there differences that we could resolve or delimit species boundaries to say that strains that infect elongate hemlock scale are different than those that cause disease on apples, you know, in Washington, or blueberries in Maine or something like that? And that's where, you know, phylogenetics and the use of DNA sequence data is really important. And we've taken some of those strains from poison ivy and we've tested them and other things. In doing some work, we realized that these Colitotrichum are really common in conifer tissue, like leaf tissue, and they just reside there asymptomatically. So what's really interesting is the fungus was first described as causing disease on this hemlock pest, yet we find them hanging out in hemlock tissues, even in the absence of the pest. So they're opportunistically invading those insects that are kind of just stationary, feeding on the needles of hemlock. But they're everywhere in the environment, just hanging out on conifer tissues, twig tissue, and needles. And they are also pathogens of these different, you know, fruits and fruit trees and things like that. So there are a lot of pathogens that have kind of this endophytic or saprophytic lifestyle, and their facultative lifestyle, that is their kind of temporary lifestyle, is that of plant pathogen. They'll step in to be a plant pathogen when the time is right, but they can exist endophytically and asymptomatically in the tissues of plants for a long time without ever doing any harm.
I mean, it blurs the line between endophyte and pathogen. And I always wonder when I hear stories like this, where different species of fungi are able to exhibit, you said facultative, I like that, this facultative capacity to have another survival strategy or food gathering strategy, you know, whether it's a fungi showing this ability to spear nematodes, or in this case, temporarily be a plant pathogen. I always wonder how many latent strategies or facultative capacities lie dormant in fungi? You know, is there some universal fungi toolkit that certain species over time gradually lose, or because of their environment, lose the need for some of those capacities, but they're there if the situation's right? So I think it's a really interesting question.
Yeah, and I think some interesting questions that arise from that is thinking about why fungi maintain those kinds of tools. Typically, we're talking about like enzymes to degrade different substrates, you know, if they don't need them. And often cases, they do need them, but only occasionally. I think about mushroom-forming fungi, the Basidium mycota versus kind of the Ascomycota, which include kind of the baker's yeast and things like that. And, you know, Basidiomycetes are known for their ability to degrade lignin. When you think about the mushrooms and these polypores that grow on the sides of trees, they really have the capacity to break down this really complex polymer, this compound lignin, and it affords them the first rights at this food source because they have these unique tools to get into the host. But a lot of Ascomycota don't have those tools, but they'll opportunistically invade, and they have enzymes to break down cellulose and hemicellulose and things like that. So they could take advantage of some of the other less complex constituents of wood. But really, fungi dominate those environments because they're the only ones that have the enzymes to break down these complex substrates.
I mean, just the fact they could create enzymes to unlock these incredibly complex carbon rings is mind-blowing enough as natural chemists. But then to think they have to create co-substrates and establish pH gradients to make the reaction work, I mean, it's incredible the fact that they have these capacities. And for any fungi that whose main survival strategy isn't based around, you know, this saprobic lifestyle or decomposing lignin, why they would keep any of that latent capacity, which would seem to be such a complex type of chemistry, how that would survive if they're not using it all the time. You get into these really interesting questions that I think you're demonstrating beautifully when you talk about these overlaps between pathogens and endophytes and kind of the different roles. I guess that's what it is. Fungi can go between these different roles, and it just seems interesting that an organism would maintain that through the evolutionary process.
Chestnut blight is a good chestnut blight pathogen, Cryphonectria parasitica, is a great example of that. You know, it obviously it has been devastating to American chestnut, but I'm not sure if you knew this, but a chestnut blight pathogen could also colonize oak and beech. And it does so typically on weakened stems or cut stumps. The one exception to that is on scarlet oak, it causes kind of what they call a butt rot on the scarlet oak, which is kind of a funny name. But it could reside and sporulate on oak as a host, and even in the absence of chestnut. So chestnut blight lives on even in the absence of chestnut because oak, which is in the same family as chestnut, and beech, which is in the same family as chestnut, serve as kind of like not ideal hosts, but hosts nonetheless.
That's incredibly interesting. And I'm just going to pray that we don't start having these things mutate to try to infect more and more oak or beech, keep those forests safe. But, you know, I think your phrase about butt rot may be the perfect segue into something that I can't let you go without talking about, which is the flying salt shakers of death and your work with Mazopora and cicadas. So we've been talking about fungal plant pathogens, but you've done a ton of work in entomopathogenic fungi and just, you know, the symbiosis that occurs in fungal arthropod interactions. We went over one of the big ones, which is ambrosia beetles farming fungi. I believe they keep them in their cheeks, putting them in the tree to grow their food source and create a home for their young. But tell us about cicadas and Mazopora, because I think this is one that blows everybody's mind when we hear about it.
Yeah, so some people call it Mazospora, people call it Mazospora, potato, potato, right?
But I'm going to defer to your pronunciation.
I worked as a traditional plant pathologist for a long time, just kind of walking the line of looking at plants and plant diseases. But if you spend enough time in a forest walking around, you often get distracted by things that are occurring in those spaces but have nothing to do with plant health. Now, cicadas are kind of an exception in that they do feed on the roots of plants as they live underground and as nymphs and develop. And if you've ever seen the aftermath of a periodical cicada emergence, you know that they also lay the eggs in the branch tips, and you see all this the branch tips die back on plants. So they do impact tree health, and on smaller landscape plants, they could kill them if they oviposit enough eggs, if enough females oviposit enough eggs into a given small plant, that could cause harm. But generally, these insect-fungus interactions that I've been studying are moving away from forest pathology and more into environmental microbiology.
Right.
Honestly, it was my grad students that got me interested in Mesospora, the cicada pathogen. I grew up in Pennsylvania, so I know what periodical cicadas are, and I've seen them before, and I've lived in other places where they've emerged. But in 2016, two of my students, Angie Macias and Matt Berger, who you interviewed, came up to me and said, hey, listen, the cicada emergence is coming up here in May. We want to study the fungus. And I was like, I don't know much about the fungus that infects cicadas. And actually, Angie, who coined the term flying salt shakers of death, wrote a blog post about it when she was at Cornell. She was an undergrad working at Cornell and wrote a blog post about the flying salt shakers of death. You know, she alerted me to her blog post. And then, you know, I said, that sounds pretty good. And a couple weeks went by and the cicadas just emerged right here on campus, like right outside my window. They brought one into me. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh God, we have to study that. It's so cool because it was walking around in their hands and its backside had been replaced by a fungal mass. It looked like it had a piece of thick chalk sticking out the back end and you could write your name on a chalkboard with it. And it was just a mass of spores and hence the name Mesospora coming out of the back of these cicadas. Yet they were moving around as if nothing was wrong. And that really fascinated us. So we went out and we had a bunch of collection tubes and collected as many as we could find. And we put them in the deep freezer and forgot about them, actually. Like a lot of scientists do. But if there's a lesson in there, and that lesson will be further reiterated later on when you realize what we found in them, is that when you have an opportunity to collect something, especially something like a periodical cicada that merges once every 17 years, and fungal incidence might be, you know, below 5% on the landscape, you need to seize the moment and sample them and then put them in storage, you know, like a deep freezer, so that you can look at them later, because that opportunity is not going to become available for another 17 years.
Sample first, ask questions later.
Yeah. We've now generated a lot of questions so that when they emerge, we already have the next question in place. But when you're first diving into a system, I think you need to sample first and ask questions later. And that's what we did. And as luck would have it, a couple years later, so this was in 2016, in around 2017, a student I was serving on his committee, his advisor retired and moved away. And I offered to take over as his advisor. And he was doing a lot of metabolomics, looking at the production of these small molecules that fungi produce. He was working in INVAM, this collection of arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi that I oversee. But, you know, it was really interesting that he was showing me some of his results, and I had yet to take over, or I was just starting to take over INVAM. So these arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi were totally foreign to me.
Right.
And he was showing me the spores, and they looked a lot like the resting spores of Mesospora. And like a light bulb went off in my head, and I thought, hey, we have a bunch of cicadas we collected last year. What if we did that like metabolomics on Mesospora the way that you've done it on all these different arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi? And this is kind of like what I was talking about earlier about this cross-fertility. Working in one project really generates ideas for the other project. And I said, could you do like a kind of global metabolomics analysis of these fungal plugs on the backs of the cicadas? Because there's some really weird behavior. And like, it could be a small molecule. It could be a metabolite, a fungal metabolite. And he said, sure, yeah, I could do that. And of course, you know, I moved on to another spinning plate and months went by. And, you know, these things don't happen overnight, these types of analyses and sample prep and replications and doing these different things. And I remember I got a call late one night in the winter. It was probably 2 a.m. and it was Greg Boyce, my PhD student, calling me. And he said, hey, I have to talk to you. And I looked at my phone and I'm like, Greg, it's 2 a.m. And my wife was like, who's calling you at 2 a.m.? He said, you know, those cicada plugs you had me look at. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you're not going to believe what I found in them. Now, what I didn't say leading up to the story is that in the meantime, Matt Berger had graduated and right. he moved out to hike the Continental Divide Trail out west, which is what he does. He's a thru-hiker. And in the meantime, he came across another population of annual cicadas that had Mesospora infections, and he shipped them immediately to me. So they were in this mix of samples that I gave to Greg. So we had periodical cicadas from here in West Virginia and annual cicadas from New Mexico that Matt Berger had collected. And he said, those cicadas from New Mexico that you gave me are loaded with psilocybin. And I said, psilocybin? He said, yeah, you know, the psychoactive compound in magic mushrooms. And I'm like, are you sure? He's like, well, the mass is right. He's like, there's a lot we have to do, but like, it's in every sample I've looked at from these annual cicadas out west. So, you know, we met the next morning all excited. And I said, okay, what are the next steps? And he said, we have to get an analytical standard and compare it to these things. If it kind of looks the same, like has the same fingerprint, essentially. Because with mass spectrometry, you know, you apply a voltage and you get a certain mass. But if you apply voltage to a parent mass, it'll fragment to like a unique fingerprint. And you can compare that fingerprint between an analytical standard and like, say, a Mesospora plug. And sure enough, we had an exact match. So we were certain that we had psilocybin from these annual cicadas.
The last thing that you'd expect, I'm sure you did not expect to find psilocybin in the hind end of these cicadas.
No. And in fact, well, I said, well, that could explain a behavior modification. Could we find something in the periodical cicadas that we had collected from West Virginia?
Yeah.
And it took a couple of weeks to get the data set together, and we're sitting here in my office. In fact, he's sitting in the chair that I'm sitting at right now to talk to you from, and I'm over across the room at my desk. And he said, wait a minute, hold on. I got something. Have you heard of cathinone? And I said, no, I don't know what cathinone is. We quickly looked it up on Wikipedia. It's an amphetamine. It's a naturally occurring amphetamine, one of the only naturally occurring amphetamines that occurs in the cat plant, the plant that's popular in the Horn of Africa and the Middle East. They chew it as a stimulant. So we've heard the name amphetamine, but a lot of amphetamines are synthetic, right?
Right.
They're man-made. But this is a naturally occurring amphetamine that occurs in a plant. And here they are showing up in a cicada plug from a periodical cicada. Now, your listeners may be familiar with amphetamines just by the name amphetamine, but also the ADHD drugs are in synthetic amphetamine. And maybe you've heard of bath salts, the kinds of illicit, legal, were legal for a time being drugs that make people bite the faces off of other people. Those are amphetamines as well. Yeah, so we're finding that the periodical cicadas are loaded with amphetamines. Now, when you think back to like how I described the first interaction with these cicadas, they're walking down your arm and flying through the air and whistling as if nothing was wrong, despite the fact that a third of their body has fallen off and been replaced by a fungal mass. What would explain that? Well, certainly an amphetamine would give you an extra little pep in your step, right? So this prolonged wakefulness we're seeing in cicadas that should be slumped over, dying on the pavement instead of like flying around, this amphetamine could provide one piece of evidence for how that behavioral modification is occurring.
So the periodical cicadas had this cathinone in them. So they have an amphetamine to keep them kind of hyperactive, despite the fact they're gradually dying, or maybe not so gradually. And then the annual cicadas, though, had psilocybin in them.
Yeah, and certainly there could be some overlap in the modification. We know that like both compounds are capable of suppressing appetite. Now, remember, the fungus is producing these. So they're producing these compounds to optimize dispersal. Right. If a cicada stops to feed, it's not spreading spores. So suppressing appetite would be one type of behavioral modification that would benefit the fungus. Because remember, these cicadas are no longer kind of in control. Their strings are being pulled by a fungus, a puppet master. It's coercing them to move around. And also the other behavior we didn't address yet is this hypersexualization.
Mating, yeah.
And we see that in male cicadas, for example, not only do they continue mating attempts with females, despite the fact that their back end is a fungal plug, and they transfer it through a copulation attempt, making it sexually transmissible. But they also pretend to be females to get males to come to them. So they're doubling the number of cicadas that they actually interact with. And this, again, is to the advantage of the fungus, which maximizes dispersal.
Now, do we have any idea how fungi, and I guess this would apply to any entomopathogenic fungi, but how they take over, I mean, the neural network or the body, you know, is it a case where they're hijacking the brain, kind of the seat, whatever brain cicadas have, or are they actually, you know, I know sometimes when you talk about cordyceps, huge portions of, let's say, the mass of an insect's leg will actually be cordyceps tissue. So do we have any idea of how complete this zombification is for the massospora?
We're just starting to really understand these things. And, you know, I said that these chemical compounds can provide some explanation of behavior modification, but there's likely an interaction with hormones as well, insect hormones, that we haven't uncovered yet. And I think there's been a lot of great work done on the zombie ant system, where they look at ophiocordyceps and how it's impacting the body there and taking over, you know, the muscles, and but also taking over maybe some of the kind of neural networks of these arthropods to manipulate behavior. So there's a lot to be uncovered there, but our initial investigations were very surprising, but they open up a whole realm of avenues or a whole number of opportunities to investigate how these compounds are modifying behavior. Now, the interesting side story I'll say here is that the next thing to do would be to dose insects directly with these compounds without the fungi to see what impact it would have on them.
But right.
These are Schedule I drugs. So they are under the regulation of the Drug Enforcement Administration. Without a DEA permit, one can't move forward with these types of bioassays. And in fact, when we discovered this in the lab, we're like, holy crap, we're sitting on two different Schedule I drugs. Like, right. We don't have permits for these things yet. Like, we're sitting on like a freezer full of cicadas, either filled with amphetamines or psilocybin. Like, so I wrote the most awkward email of my life to the DEA and self-reported it, asking, do I have to do anything to be in compliance, right, or how do
I don't want to get arrested for my cicadas. Yeah.
I don't want to like go to publish this and then publish being held up because, you know, we didn't have a permit or something. So I went and asked their opinion. And of course they said, you know, it was an inadvertent discovery. You weren't trying to concentrate it, you know, so it's fine. But, you know, it got a lot of other people interested in cicadas. Like, I noticed, just as a joke, I used to listen to the band Fish in high school and college. I went into like some of the Fish forum websites and saw people talking about, like, joking about cicadas at fish lots. And I thought that was like, you've made it. Like, when your science has become the talk of a parking lot, you know, outside a fish venue, then you've made it.
You've officially arrived as a scientist. I noticed that in one of the articles you did. Obviously, there's a lot of press surrounding this discovery. One of the articles you did, the interview, asked that obvious question of, well, can we feel the effects of these substances by eating the cicadas? And your response was something to the effect of, you'd have to be pretty dedicated. I wouldn't try it.
The dose was low. But the other thing was, that was just two of like 1,500 metabolites we found in those plugs. And some of those are like kind of toxins. I would not eat those fungal plugs. You know, we know what's in magic mushrooms because we've looked at them. But this is, this could be an independent evolution of psilocybin production. So therefore, its intermediates and whatnot could be totally different. And we don't know what kind of effect that would have on vertebrates. So I think we have to be really careful with, it's funny to think about, but also it's scary to think about.
Yeah, we don't want to take it too lightly. The analogs that some of these substances have obviously are not to be trifled with, even if they are studied, much less in this cocktail of different metabolites in this fungi. And it begs the question of, how well studied was Massospora? Now, when I search on the internet, it's everywhere because of your guys' discovery. But how much do we know about this fungi before your work with cicadas?
So let's start at the beginning. Massospora was first described in the 1870s. The years are kind of blurry now. But
late 1800s. Wow, a lot longer than I thought.
Yeah, it remained kind of a mycological oddity for like 100 years. But there was a guy named Richard Soper who really took it upon himself to investigate Mesospora and like formally described 12 species back in the 60s and 70s, did a lot of like natural history work. I mean, his publications really formed the basis for our understanding of this system. And we depended on them largely for forming hypotheses and trying to understand the disease cycle. But since our discovery, we've published 3 papers now on Mesospora, including a updated kind of phylogeny. That is, we look at the genetic relationships among or the evolutionary relationships among closely allied species and see, you know, like how they're related. My student Angie published that last year. Our first paper came out in 2019. My postdoc published a paper last year where in PLOS pathogens, where we kind of tried to better summarize what's known about the life cycle and the disease cycle and kind of visualize that. Because a lot of what's happening is happening underground. And we don't necessarily know the timing of that. We think we know it, but, you know, until you dig these up and experimentally validate those things, you know, it's a little speculative. We're just trying to fill in the gaps. But certainly we've established kind of a network of people that are willing to send us samples and collaborate with us. We have a collaborator in Chile. We resolved that species from Chile on a cicada genus down there in our paper in 2020. So like we are making connections with a lot of people. Really, we've become known as the lab where you just send random dead sporulating insects to. You know, I've received a couple specimens in like absolute vodka airplane shooters, all kinds of weird things where people send me, you know, like just a folded napkin with they don't even tell me it's coming. It just comes to the mail. I open it. Like I've received so many dead animals after our Mesospora discovery. And it's not just cicadas. It's flies. It's, you know, all kinds of insects and other arthropods, spiders, millipedes.
Okay, so we thought it was when your science was being referenced in a fish parking lot, but it's actually when you start getting envelopes full of dead insects that you've truly arrived on the scientific scene. And let that be a clarion call. You know, at the end of this, I want to give out your contact information so everyone can send you their fungus-infected insects. You can just channel it over to Matt Kasson in the lab there at West Virginia. But what are the next questions for you guys? What next steps are you pursuing in examining this relationship?
Well, we're pursuing grants to better understand the genomes of these fungi. It turns out that the genomes of these fungi are huge. And oftentimes, or sometimes with specialization, like with these entomopathogens, you get like a reduction in genome size. So the genomes are a lot smaller than maybe their counterparts. But like in the case of these fungi, they're 10 to 20 times bigger than the genomes of other entomopathogens. And why is that? Like, why do they have so much in there? What are they doing with all that? All those genes and coding material, like what's hidden in the genomes of these things that could further explain their kind of unique and highly specialized lifestyle? That's something we're looking into. We're also looking at other entomopterellian fungi, these close relatives of Mesospora, and saying, are there small molecules present in the fungal plugs of those infected insects that could explain the behavior modification? Because cicadas aren't the only ones that fly around whistling as if nothing's wrong. There's another pathogen called Strongwellsia that impacts flies, and it opens up a perfect hole in their abdomen, yet they fly around as if they don't have a hole in their abdomen. That's obviously the same. We call that active host transmission. It keeps the host alive to spread its spores rather than killing it and then sporulating or exploding out of the cadaver. We're trying to understand things that unify this active host transmission, and that's a big pursuit of ours right now. But that's just one spinning plate. If we can kind of step back and again look at the lab, like we are really enjoying the work we're doing on behavioral modification by fungi and fungus arthropod interactions. But we're also looking at kind of the fungal mutualists or the fungal partners of millipedes now, and that's a big one that we've just. Well, we've been working on that since 2014, and we published our first big paper on that in 2019, but we just got word that we're funded by National Geographic Society to explore the fungal biodiversity of half the fungus feeding millipedes across the United States.
And you sent that to me before our interview. Said, you know, I don't know if this would be relevant. Of course, this is relevant. This is incredibly interesting. Yes. So let's talk about the work you're going to be undertaking with National Geographic, and maybe even just a quick backdrop on the fungal diversity that your lab has found in the humble millipede.
Yeah. So a lot of people maybe are familiar with millipede. They might recognize them by look. They often might confuse millipedes and centipedes, but, you know, millipedes are these, a lot like earthworms, they're the detritus eating soil turnover invertebrates that just kind of hang out on the floors of forests and break down leaf litter, turn it over, turn it into poop, and help to kind of with nutrient cycling and things like that. And millipedes are really fascinating in themselves because they're among the first air breathing animals on the planet. And we know this because of the fossil record. They date back over 400 million years ago. Now, around 250 to 300 million years ago, a group of millipedes broke off from the leaf litter eating millipedes and started feeding exclusively on fungi. And, you know, exclusive fungal feeding is kind of rare in the animal kingdom. You know, we see it in like leafcutter ants, we see it in ambrosia beetles, we see it in some termites, but it's pretty rare. Now, millipedes were the first because, I mean, millipedes are the first terrestrialized land animals. And this group of fungus feeding millipedes, you know, started off 250 million years ago. And, you know, there's about 400 known species in this group called the Culibugnatha. This is the group of fungus feeding millipedes. And, you know, when I was at Virginia Tech, I was a postdoc and they had just hired this diplopodologist, which is the someone who studies millipedes. They hired this guy, Paul Merrick. And I went to one of his seminars, and the last slide of his talk was showing this one fungus-feeding millipede, Brachycybe. And he said, there's this whole group of millipedes that feed exclusively on fungi, and not a single person has ever investigated the fungi they feed on. And as it turns out, he was exactly right, except for one sentence in a 1975 paper that said, one millipede, we think, feeds on this one fungus. And that one sentence was the complete body of literature on the fungus diversity or the fungal diversity from fungus-feeding millipedes.
Highly understudied, yeah.
Yeah. So I connected with Paul, and he said one of the most well-known fungus-feeding millipedes is this millipede Brachycybe leconteii, and it's really common throughout the whole eastern United States. It turns out its northernmost range is in southern West Virginia, and I'm at West Virginia University, and I was at Virginia Tech, which is near southern West Virginia. And I said, okay, well, let's collaborate on this. And he taught me how to find millipedes. You know, he basically taught me everything I know. And then I took on my student, Angie, who also worked on the cicada stuff. Everyone in my lab works on everything besides their main thing. Angie took on her master's and now her PhD to really understand the fungal communities of these millipedes. And we sampled across all the eastern states and also went to another population that occurs in Arkansas and eastern Oklahoma. Believe it or not, there's mountains in Oklahoma. If you didn't know this, eastern Oklahoma is beautiful. And we sampled millipedes there, and we basically crushed them up, and we looked at all the fungal communities of some 300-plus millipedes across these seven states and 20 locations. And we found tremendous fungal diversity, probably some 300-plus species of fungi, including seven that were unique to science, never been described before.
Incredible. So you were finding new fungi. So the digestive systems of these millipedes were basically kind of these fungal herbariums, if you will, full of diversity.
Yeah, we refer to them as the biodiversity hotspots. So these millipedes in themselves are not just fungal foragers, but they're truly biodiversity hotspots. And we went on to use kind of special analysis to figure out who the core members of these fungal communities are. So one of the things we did is we collected them, and we collected part of the logs. So they would often be found on the underside of logs feeding on fungi. So we would collect a piece of the log to identify the tree species that they were on.
Right.
And we were able to kind of form a network and figure, say, across all plant hosts, across all states, across all locations, what fungi show up the most common? And we were able to kind of figure out what the core network is based on culturable communities. And now we follow that up with a culture-independent study where we collected millipedes from three locations, and we extracted all the DNA from them and said, who's there based on just DNA? Not culturable fungi, but like also those interesting, potentially unculturable partners. So that study is, we sent that out for sequencing, and we should have the results from that by the spring. And we really leveraged that, you know, in January before the pandemic and before anybody knew what was coming. Angie and I put in a National Geographic grant. There was a call for grants on biodiversity. And given the biodiversity we had uncovered in these millipedes, we said, well, we should do this for more millipedes and just see how diverse it is. Maybe we'll uncover a branch of the fungal tree of life that like we don't even know about.
Right.
Because a lot of the specialized microbes can't be cultured. So we don't even know what's in the results from the DNA-based study of the one Brachycyte leucantii. But we put, we leveraged some of the culture-based data to say, we can do this. We've studied this. We want to study it on 25 different species across the U.S., including places like urban environments like Miami, you know, rural places like Yosemite, and really well-known places like Yosemite, and everywhere in between, including more rural hotspots in West Virginia and deep in the Appalachian Mountains, where there is a lot of millipede diversity. So we're going out this year, and we're not taking our big trip out west till after vaccination, but we'll be traveling by car here in March to take our first trip down into the Southeast United States and into Florida, down the Gulf Coast and up the Atlantic Coast to sample millipedes.
So you guys will be going out foraging, not necessarily for mushrooms, but for millipedes. And I had questions written here, you know, what are the commonalities between the fungi they're eating? Is there a certain type of fungi? But I guess we're waiting for those results to really figure out what the commonalities are with the food source here. But that's just incredible. And I think it highlights something, you know, about science. And as we develop more tools, we're able to ask some of these deeper questions and take a look at things. But there's still so much ground to cover. I mean, we're talking about the earliest terrestrial animal on the planet. And the fact that there are some huge questions here that we're just starting to ask really hints at just all these routes for exploration that are ripe. And I think so much of your work does that, where you're taking a look at things and asking these fundamental questions. And it's really inspiring to see how much ground there is left to cover and how many big questions we have still left to ask.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment. I will say that like the thing that I've learned in my own work, and I really try to pass on to my students, is that I think traditionally a lot of people thought, I have to go somewhere really unique and really far away to discover something truly worthy. But the reality is that there are things hidden right below our feet. There are discoveries to be made right outside my office window in Mesospora plugs and cicadas and in ambrosia beetle heads over the bank and underneath logs, you know, in between coal mines in southern West Virginia. These are places that people have walked and walked over and stepped on and didn't take a pause to say, well, what's happening there? And, you know, I'm not trying to say I'm the only one that does this, but there's value in taking time to look at things. I'm a really big fan of natural history. And part of the reason that we don't understand certain, you know, like let's go back to the cicada thing. The reason that we were able to make some interesting discoveries about cicadas is because someone took the time to make some really important natural history discoveries about what cicadas do in the absence of fungi. What are they doing? Like, what's their mating rituals? What are they doing when they emerge? There's some really amazing cicada scientists out there that have just devoted their careers to understanding what they do just normally. And because there's such that body of literature, we're able to like leverage that to understand when behavior deviates from what's expected. So without those natural histories, you know, like millipedes are understudied. We don't know anything about their normal behavior. So it's really important to get that fundamental knowledge of how they're feeding, what they're doing, how they're rearing young, are they social, are they subsocial? All these questions are still to be answered about these systems.
And that's what's so interesting when you hear about pretty much any kind of scientific inquiry, any kind of cataloging of the natural world, is you inevitably are building into that tower of natural history that later scientists can pull from. My questions when I interview a lot of mycologists and forest pathologists, pretty much anyone, I'm always asking, you know, what can we apply from this? Is there some metabolite you've discovered that now we can pull and apply somewhere else? Or I have a very kind of almost biased anthropocentric view of it. How can we use this? But, you know, more and more, I'm starting to get comfortable with the fact that we don't need to understand exactly how to use it right away. The actual importance is to get that baseline information and start building our knowledge base of the natural world, you know, ad infinitum. And then later on down the road, people can pull from that. And I think you just described that process beautifully. And you've mentioned one kind of partner in crime there in the lab, which is Angie. But what's it been like for you to run kind of this vibrant lab there at West Virginia? You know, tell us a little bit about the lab and how that's contributed to your own growth as a scientist and a naturalist.
Yeah, I've been fortunate, and certainly, you know, I mentioned Angie because she's leading up a couple of the projects that we've talked about. But I've been blessed with some great students. I've mentored 6 master's students and 3 PhD students through completion already, and I currently in the lab have a master's student Molly, PhD student Ellie, and my PhD student Angie, who I mentioned. So, and I have a postdoc Brian who's in the lab, and a group of really talented undergraduates who are doing independent research too, Hannah, Jordan, and Hosanna. And I have some new ones coming on to join the Millipede Project, Shelby, and some other folks too. But yeah, I've been really blessed with students that came in with kind of that strong background in spending time in the woods, natural history, just obsessed with insects, obsessed with fungi, obsessed with botany, obsessed with trees. You know, like they love all of it, and I allow them to do all of it. And, you know, like they get their stuff done. They're just excited to participate in the extra stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, my students also benefit because they get on all these publications too, because they're going out and collecting and contributing to these different projects in addition to their main project. So if you look at a lot of our papers, it's 27, 30 authors, of which 10 of them are from the lab because they all contribute meaningfully to those projects. So it's been really inspiring to have the students, you know, bounce ideas off me, but also like interact with each other. We have a really good community here. It's very collaborative. People helping each other with lab work. And I'm looking to take on some new students. I have recruited one student, PhD student, to work on chestnut blight in our chestnut blight project in the fall. And I'll be taking on another student to work on the Tree of Heaven verticillium project here. I haven't advertised that yet, but that's another thing that I'll be looking for a student for. So constantly bringing on new people, writing for grants to fund people that are here and bring new people on. But it's been, you know, being a principal investigator or PI is what they call academics that run labs. It's 30 jobs, you know, in one.
Right.
You have to be a small business owner that knows how to run the books and balance budgets. And you have to know how to deal with like HR issues. And you have to be able to be a scientist on top of that. And obviously you're good at some and you're bad at others and you're trying to grow in those areas, but it's been really inspiring. And I feel blessed with the people that have been around me, because honestly, like the science, this myth of like the solitary genius doing work, that it is just that. It's a myth. The greatest science out there is collaborative. It's multinational. It's diverse. You know, people bringing in unique perspectives. And I feel like the best science I've done has involved groups from across the globe contributing in unique ways. And there's no solitary genius pulling the ropes. You know, it's the collective intelligence and kind of resources of the group.
You know, it comes through so clearly when you talk about it. You have such a deep passion for your work, and it sounds like just such a fun group to be a part of. So do you have any advice for people who want to start studying, whether it be, you know, forest ecosystems, fungi specifically, any broad advice there? And where can people send applications to your lab, more importantly?
Well, actually, if people want to find out more about our lab, you can reach out through social media. You don't have to send a formal or an email. I get people that direct message me on Twitter, and I don't think that's inappropriate, because I mean, that's the reason I'm on social media, is to communicate science to the broader public, but it's also to interact with students that, you know, maybe that's their only means of reaching out and they feel comfortable doing that. And kudos to them for like reaching out, because, you know, sometimes it's intimidating to reach out to a scientist and say, hey, I'd like to work for you. But like, I'll tell you that I've recruited my most recent postdoc. We were friends on Twitter first. And, you know, he's done some really impressive work, and we're doing some really exciting work right now. But I really appreciated the stuff he was doing on social media to like advocate for policies that are science-based and like diversity and inclusion and these broader social issues that are important. There's been a lot of pushback against people that use social media and science communication and saying like, oh, that takes away from your research. I think that's a load of crap. I do a lot of research every year. I publish a lot of papers. I write grants. But I love also putting posts out about moldy Twinkies. And, you know, it's fun. And you know what? Those types of interactions connect with millions of people. Our 2020 thing to figure out what fungus was colonizing an eight-year-old Twinkie was seen by millions of people. If only 10 of those became slightly interested in mycology because of it, that's 10 people we didn't have before. You know, so like, if you're not meeting people where they are, you're going to miss them. You know, like, everybody knows about Twinkies. Everybody knows about Peeps. So why not try to use those experiences as a vehicle to teach something about mycology?
And, you know, social media is the most powerful communication tool that this planet has ever seen. Right. So when you have it at your disposal, to not use it seems like a totally missed opportunity. And that's honestly how I found you and really dove into your work was through Twitter. So I appreciate that you're out there being this kind of beacon, putting out information, making it approachable. Because I think that's another thing when we get into scientific discussions, you know, the more that science is approachable, the easier it is for people not to throw up defenses against it or see it, basically have any antagonistic relationship with those who more formally practice science. And, you know, maybe those who are more of kind of citizen scientists, it really starts to bring that together when you do make it approachable and put it out on these mainstream platforms.
I will say there are great – iNaturalist is such a valuable tool for citizen science work and things like that. And certainly I've reached out to people through iNaturalist posts, and people have reached out to me through Twitter, the amateurs that – and I don't use that in a derogatory way. Amateur is a compliment, not an insult.
Right.
They're just not formally trained in botany or mycology, but they're really passionate about it. And they'll say, hey – I read your article on cicadas, and I actually took this picture of an infected spider 2 years ago, and I just was looking back through my archives, and I wanted to see if you knew what it was. We've gotten specimens that way. So, I mean, it's really valuable, the kinds of connections that you form, and it just feels so much more meaningful than this. Just like, I'm in the ivory tower. I'm going to stay here and only talk to academics. I mean, that's not why I'm doing this. I love to connect with people and school age kids and high schoolers and retired teachers that picked up mycology because they grew up in, you know, walking in the forest and they're passionate about it. So,
yeah, I mean, with the massive interconnected system that is nature that we're trying to examine, it would only make sense that we need our own massive interconnected system to try to help map it out. And I just love your whole ethos surrounding this. And obviously, we haven't talked before this interview, but you just have a lot of passion. And I love your viewpoint on all this.
Yeah.
Where can people find more about you and your lab and your work and interact with you? Where are the best places to go?
Sure. Yeah. I have a front page at West Virginia University. I'm in the Division of Plant and Soil Sciences. And I have a page there. You know, honestly, I would encourage anybody to check out my Twitter feed, because I do a lot of stuff there. And you know, if you want to see my papers, like my WVU site has kind of some papers, but I also have a Google Scholar page where people can check out my papers. But like, you know, feel free to reach out through Twitter or through email. I'm happy to talk to anybody and give advice. But like you said, advice for people that want to get into this, it's like, if you're passionate about it, don't be afraid to pursue it. It's hard sometimes because, you know, we're right now in an economy and in a circumstance where there's not a lot of jobs. We're training a lot of people and there's not as many jobs for those people. So I would say to people that say, I want a PhD in mycology or something like that, I'd say, what's your dream job? And do you need a PhD to do that job? Because, you know, maybe you just need a master's, or maybe you could do that with having a bachelor's. Like, I knew I wanted to be a university professor once I started my undergraduate education. And I knew that I had to pursue that through. But I would also say that, like, if someone's looking to get into mycology, you know, start a little broader. Pursuing a degree in biology or environmental microbiology is a good way to start, because that way you have way more opportunities to move in different directions once you finish. You're not confined to like one career path that way. You're being broad where you can say, oh, you know what? I want to do genetics, or I want to do mycology. I'm sure of it now. Or I want to do medical school. You know, microbiology is a really good undergraduate degree for medical school, but just as it's a great degree for mycology or plant pathology. So train broadly and also continue to maintain your passions. Like when you get into your studies, you know, you're going to hit areas where times when it just feels mundane and you're not as inspired. But if you maintain these passions, you know, like I'm really passionate about fungi and I get paid to study them. So when I have time off, I go out in the woods with my kids and we look for fungi. But like I do that because we enjoy it. My kids enjoy being outside and playing with sticks and kind of the way that I was brought up. It might seem like insane that I'm not promoting work-life balance, but I am. If your passion is knitting or your passion is oil painting or bird photography, like keep those because you need them to inspire you in addition to your science. It turns out that my science and my hobby are one and the same. So I'm always looking out for fungi. In fact, what's really cool is like I talked earlier about some of the fungi that I've come across, and a couple of the new fungi that I've discovered, my kids have been present when I've discovered them.
Oh, that's amazing.
It really is so meaningful because every time I read the paper or read something on it, I'm immediately transported back to that moment standing there with my kids when I made the discovery. And that makes it so much more meaningful to me.
Yeah. Well, for you, the work-life balance is inevitably blurred, but I like what you're saying about the crosstalk across disciplines, even non-scientific disciplines, you know, just things you're passionate about, how they inform research in other areas. I think your career has seen that, where people are drawing inspiration from all different angles to pursue a field of research, really holistic viewpoint that you're putting out. And, you know, my question that I had to ask was if you do go foraging for mushrooms, because that's what I'm really into, and I'm relieved to hear that you do and you take your kids along.
It's kind of nerdy, but like my middle guy, he's really the most passionate about fungi, and he probably knows 20 to 30 different species of fungi. Mostly he loves polypores because he can collect them and bring them back to his room. So he has a large collection of polypores. But, you know, they know Amanitas, and they'll always point to them and say, my six-year-old will say to my four-year-old, you don't touch that. Remember, that's an Amanita. But yeah, I love foraging for fungi and, you know, like chicken of the woods and lion's mane and, you know, morels and chanterelles. I'd say chicken of the woods and lion's mane are my two favorite, but I do love lobster mushrooms, although we don't have as many here as we had up in Maine when I was studying there. And, you know, there tend to be more of these conifer-dominated forests, but I love edible mushrooms. In fact, we have oyster mushrooms growing on our countertop right now. We got my son a box kit for Christmas.
Oh, that's awesome. Like I said, that's what really drove my passion and got me to study mycology and be much more interested in the vast array of fungi other than the ones we can eat. So yeah, there's some inexorable relationship there between the ones that we can eat and all the different fungi. It's just the most tangible way we can interact.
But maybe I was meant to study fungi and I didn't know why, but it's because I love bread so much. You know, bread, everybody likes bread and beer, and you know, baker's yeast is an incredible fungus and it does incredible things, and it's often overlooked. I mean, people will always talk about the mold that's growing on their bread, that, you know, their fresh non-preservative bread they bought at the farmer's market. Yet they don't think about the fungi that went into making the bread or making the beer.
And they're rock stars when you talk about research too. The Saccharomyces yeast are these rock star model organisms that I know a lot of people use to study fungal systems. So yes, you can't ever underappreciate those yeasts. And it is funny, that connection that fungi inevitably have, I mean, with every system really, but especially with our food systems, and how, you know, that relationship between humans and fungi through food has been there from time immemorial. But it leads me into my question, and this doesn't have to be an edible mushroom, so I don't want to connect them too strongly, but my question of what is a mushroom or a fungi that you love and why? Doesn't have to be a favorite, just one that is inspiring you in the moment, maybe.
Yeah, I actually, so Are we talking about mushrooms or are we just talking about fungi?
I expanded it to fungi because I know that opens up a huge universe.
Yeah, you know, since my master's days, so I did my master's at the University of Maine up in northern Maine, and I worked on beech bark disease, which is a canker disease caused by two Neonectria species. They produce small red fruiting bodies that look like kind of pimples. They're smaller than like Nerds candy, but imagine if a tree had hundreds of pimples on it. I'm sitting right next to a bunch of them. In fact, I can maybe show you one. You can see all the red pimply
structures. I can see those little red pimples, yeah.
Yeah, and so these fungi are in the Nectariaceae, and I've been passionate about them since my master's. It's really the fungus I cut my teeth on, and I learned a lot about how fungi work, their ecology, their biology. And my student Cameron, who finished last year in April, defended his PhD was on these fungi, and we did surveys across the central Appalachian Mountains looking for hidden reservoirs for these fungi, and we found new species. In fact, this was the story I was just relaying earlier about being present with my kids when I discovered this fungus for the first time. This is one of these Corynectria species that we'll formally describe in a paper here coming up. But you know, they form these small red fruiting bodies that contain these ascospores, these sexual spores. And, you know, most people walk right by them. But I am just so obsessed with them. And everywhere I go, I look for them. And everywhere I go, I find them. Like, I found them on so many hosts now. And we're really starting to uncover some really interesting stories about them. So I'm going to continue to obsess about them and work on them. And even my kids, everywhere we go, they're like, hey, dude, let's look for red dots. You know, they're constantly looking for these fungi, the Neonectria and Corynectria and, you know, a couple other closely allied Thelonectria. And those are the genera of these red parathecial producing fungi. But a lot of them are canker pathogens, so they cause problems on trees. And it's just something that I continue to be really passionate about.
I would imagine a walk through the woods with you would be an incredible experience, but probably a pretty slow experience because you'd be looking at every single tree, every piece of wood, and finding some kind of fungi on it. You know, oh, this could be a pathogen, or yeah, this is a Nectria.
Yeah, it's really funny that you say this because when I go into the field with my students on their specific projects, they always say, focus, Matt, focus. You know, they're like, Matt, we're here to study fungus X. So you need to shut off your fungus Y and fungus Z. Put on your fungus Y and Z blinders because, you know, we have to get some stuff done.
Don't let Matt Kasson out in the woods. You know, we gotta rein him in a little bit.
Right. There's a lot of reining in going on by, you know, thanks to my grad students. But, you know, we take some time. Sometimes we go to the woods. We have these trips where we're like, this was before the pandemic, but like we would say, who wants to go to the woods today? Just look for stuff. And we would just go out and look for stuff. And we had no specific target.
And that explains how you come to have hundreds of spinning plates when you're out there observing and taking in everything. And, you know, a broad question that kind of we've nibbled around the edges of in this vein is what has a relationship with fungi, fungal organisms? What has that given to you? You know, how is that deepened your life, offered you new perspectives? What has that given to you? How has it changed your life?
I just feel like I'm contributing somehow to the broader body of scientific literature. And it feels great to be a scientist. And we're at a time where it feels important to be a scientist because, you know, science is being pushed up against and questioned and things like that. And I feel like we've been quietly doing our science for a long time. Certainly we get these media splashes on flying salt shakers of death and, you know, and mummy Twinkies and things like that. But there's thousands upon thousands of scientists doing quiet work that's really meaningful and really important. And it's basic science that could uncover something that ends up being really important a decade from now. And I respect and appreciate those scientists doing that work because I too have spent many a day and many a year doing work that, like, you know, you publish in paper and you get citations, but like you wonder if you're actually making a difference, you know, and to be validated and to say, you know what, your work does matter is it feels really nice to have someone say that.
Everyone who's participating in this scientific process to examine the natural world inevitably is making this meaningful contribution that builds and builds and builds into the future. That old phrase, we stand on the shoulders of giants, I think it
yeah. is true. And, you know, as scientists, we often find ourselves saying the same thing over and over again. It's like, we want to do good science that stands the test of time. You can publish papers real fast these days, but right. you want to do science that stands the test of time. When you look back to some of these observations that were made pre-DNA, pre-microscope, you're like, and it still holds up. You're like, gosh, that was really good science. And they took the time. You know, sometimes it's luck, of course, but like there's a lot of time and energy that goes into this that's it's obviously recognized by you and it's recognized by people, but like it's unrecognized by many.
On that inspiring note, what is your kind of greatest hope or best case scenario for our future moving forward, you know, as humanity or as a society or as a culture moving forward and developing this ever-evolving relationship with fungi? What's your greatest hope for how that is going to play out or how that's going to change things for the better?
Well, I think specifically for fungi, it's just a hope of a broader appreciation for the unseen roles that fungi play in our everyday lives, from the beer and yeast and bread example to, you know, thinking about how, you know, if we didn't have fungi breaking down dead trees and logs in the floors of forests, our piles of wood would be miles high. They're serving roles in the environment for opening up complex substrates to make it available for other organisms to use. And I wish that there was a little bit more appreciation for that and integration of mycology into high school curricula for celebrating these things. Certainly, entomology has made its way into high school curricula with examples of, you know, fruit flies, breeding fruit flies for certain traits and things like that. I did that myself in a rural high school in Northeast Pennsylvania. But I didn't learn about fungi until I got to college. So there's a lack of appreciation, or there's just a lack of coverage in high school curricula. So my hope would be that there'd be more examples put into kind of standardized curricula for various AP courses and things like that.
Yeah, you should not be able to go through AP environmental science without talking pretty extensively about fungi.
And maybe they do. I went to such a rural school that we didn't have AP courses. So it's possible that they cover all those things. But the fact is that my eyes were so open to fungi or so blown away by the things that fungi do, and other people have the same experiences, mean that there's a broad swath of the general public that doesn't really know what fungi are, what they do. And my goal is to try to connect with them on a personal level and tell them why it's important and why fungal biodiversity matters.
Right. And I think every mycophile at some point has said, I wish I knew about mushrooms, or I wish I knew about fungi sooner. So I think you're right on there in terms of introducing this information sooner, whether it's in our education system or like you're doing, whether it's just from generation to generation. That's a great hope to see moving forward, is that this information becomes more integrated in our society. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing just tons of information. And I know you have this massive kind of ever-evolving body of work there in the lab. You know, we didn't talk about mycorrhizal metabolites, which is hugely interesting, frontier of mycology. You know, that'll be for the next podcast. But thank you so much for being so generous with your time and your stories. It was just a joy to get to speak with you.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed talking with you as well. This has been a real nice experience. One that would really allowed me to talk about things I hadn't talked about before. So I really appreciate the venue and the ability to kind of go off on a tangent about things.